Welcome and happy Friday. This is Travelogue, the podcast of Condé Nast Traveler. We are here in the podcast studios. I've got Meredith Carey, Sebastian Modak, and Bridget Hallinan, all of whom are podcast veterans at this point. Say hello, people.
Hello.
Hi.
My name's Brad Rickman, and we have a couple of housekeeping things to take care of before we get into this week's topic. The first one of these is a correction. So in our plastics podcast on June 8th, we lumped Nespresso in with other single-use plastic products and vendors. That was not accurate. I did not know that. I'm actually a Nespresso user, and I did not realize that that was true. Nespresso's pods, it turns out, are made from aluminum. Even touching them, it's a little hard to tell because of the way that the aluminum is machined. But aluminum is quite recyclable, of course, and Nespresso does, in fact, have a recycling program that's relatively robust, at least in terms of the consumer-facing piece of it. So here's what you can do if you are a Nespresso user and want to recycle your pods. This is something you should do. This is something I'm going to do. You can get recycling bags directly from Nespresso, so they will ship them to you if you order from Nespresso. If you order your coffee from Nespresso, they'll give them to you for free. But you can also pick them up from Nespresso boutiques. These are things that exist typically inside existing retailers like Macy's or Bloomingdale's, just in case you're wondering what a Nespresso boutique is. I did not know. Yeah. You can order them online, which is, you know, among the easier ways to do that if you're an internet person. You can call them and they have a customer relations department and a recycling program and you can ask for it there. I'm not a phone person myself, so I would not be opting for that, but you can if you are a phone person. And they will give you a prepaid return package, and then you can take that return package, and again, did not know this, but it's kind of cool. They have a program with UPS, so you can drop them off at UPS drop locations like the UPS store or other drop-offs, UPS drop boxes. Also, Office Depot and Staples, did not know that UPS was connected with those, but in any case, you can. So that's actually fairly convenient. And then the other thing you can do is take them to Sur La Table and Williams-Sonoma. They have a partnership with those retailers. So it is good to know that, and it does make me feel a lot better about drinking coffee. Other housekeeping things, just to get them out of the way. Women Who Travel is in season 3 right now. What's on tap, Mare?
So we've got a lot coming up. We are still working out our schedule for the rest of the summer. So if you've been listening and you have ideas for us, please let Lale, Erikoglu, and I know. Coming up, we have Secrets from Expats, which I think will be really fun. We have a bunch in office and then maybe a few people, surprise guests coming on as well. And we just recorded a really fun episode about the curse of the beach read and why.
I love the title, by the way, when my feed.
I think that, you know, it's something that when we were talking in a previous episode about all the books that we loved and would read again before a trip to Europe, we just kind of got carried away, honestly. We realized that we love talking about books, and then we also realized that so many beach reads are considered fluff, and they're almost always written by women. So we wanted to kind of turn that on its head, talk about all the books we love reading at the beach, exclusively written by women, of course, and it was a really great episode.
Okay, subscribe to that. There's more stuff coming. And then the final housekeeping thing here, the Reader's Choice Awards. So your chance to review travel, which not everybody gets to do, and that is ending. Voting ends at midnight on Saturday, June 30th, which is tomorrow, if you're listening to this on the release date. You should go vote now if you haven't already. Again, it's your chance to have the voice, but there's also prizes. So you can win. Our grand prize is a 2-week Viking ocean cruise, which is actually pretty spectacular. And here's the thing. If you have already voted, you can still vote again. Every time that you vote, every time you fill out a survey, which takes literally, you know, like a minute and a half. Unless you want to write a tome about your experience, which is cool.
Which you are totally welcome to do. Yeah. We do read them.
We actually do read them. Someday, we promise, they'll be on the website. We're working on that. But in the meantime, every time you fill out a survey, you get an entry into the sweepstakes, so you increase your chances of winning. In a similar fashion, you can also share the survey with friends, relatives, acquaintances, or just emails you hoover up on the internet. I'm not here to judge. And every time a friend of yours comes and completes a survey from a link that you've sent out, the sharing link you've sent out, you will get an entry into the survey. So it's there's lots of ways to increase your chances of winning that awesome cruise. And also just to give us feedback on your travel experiences. It helps us editorially and it helps your fellow travelers. So with all of that out of the way, we turn to a more somber topic. If you noticed in the Barcelona podcast, I'm not sure how well we hid this, that was a grim day for us. That was June the 8th. That was the day that Anthony Bourdain passed away. And we were all a little bit shaken up. We'd spent the day figuring out what to do about it, what to say about it, because it was obviously big news in our world, in addition to being sort of a blow to many of us. He was an inspirational figure. And we didn't do such a hot job during that podcast, I thought, of keeping it together. I, in particular, again, I think Brett is a terrific editor. He probably hid some of this, but I did not feel like my shit was tight. And I did not feel in a mood to talk about, you know, one of my favorite cities on earth. But we soldiered through it. And what it meant was that we didn't have a chance to mark the passing of Anthony Bourdain. And so we wanted to come back to that this week and take a moment to acknowledge his influence on the travel world. And so the collection of folk here are people who paid particular attention. We all did, but paid particular attention to his work. And we thought we would talk a little bit about his influence on travel. I'm sure you've read lots of things about his influence on the food world. There's less out there talking about what he did for travel, and we have a particular perspective on that. So I wanted to start maybe with Kitchen Confidential, which was his entry into the public consciousness in a major way, and is a book I read when it was first published back in the day and was kind of explosive. And I'm also older than the rest of you cats. And I can remember...
You just called us cats, Brad.
That's to demonstrate. Damn. QED. Right? QED.
Whippersnappers, the lot of us. Yeah.
You kids. You don't know nothing about travel writing. I was connected with people in the food world both before and after that book, certainly more after. And there was definitely a before that book came out and an after that that book came out. And I'm curious, has everybody read this book?
Yes,
read
it, so yeah. Nope. I...
Bridget!
I'm sorry.
Now's the time.
It's on my list.
Do you read books?
No.
Okay,
I'm
so fair enough. I didn't mean it like that.
And I write for a travel publication.
I didn't mean it like that. I just meant like, you know.
I actually came to it like the wrong way. Like, I read A Cook's Tour, which he wrote afterwards when he had was still with the Travel Channel and doing the show A Cook's Tour. I read that before I read Kitchen Confidential. So I kind of knew him as the Globetrotter before I did the kind of behind the scenes, down and dirty look at what goes on in the kitchen. But I do think, we can get into this, I do think there are similarities in his approach to the stories he tells in both those worlds.
Well, one of the things that I think is a hallmark that came across in that book that was explosive, just in and of itself, was the no bullshit attitude. Again, he didn't invent any of these things necessarily, but he mainstreamed them in a way that was infectious and that was kind of unavoidable at the time. That book started as an article. I mean, I'm sure he'd written the whole thing, but it started as an article in The New Yorker.
Right.
I think the title was Why I Don't Eat Fish on Mondays, or Why You Should Never Order Fish on Mondays.
Don't eat before reading this.
Okay, don't eat before reading this. Anyway, the fact that he kind of like broke it down in a real way and in real language, free of kind of hype. Certainly there was attitude, but free of kind of PR hype, which I think the restaurant industry up until that time sort of hid behind, like a lot of other industries, not singling them out. But, you know, any public-facing business tends to hide behind that stuff. And he just exploded all of that and did it from an unassailable perspective of having been there and having been on the inside and doing it. So it wasn't somebody coming from the outside and doing an expose, you know, doing investigative journalism and exposing this kind of thing. That would have, I think, provoked a very different kind of reaction than what happened with him.
You know, especially with the books that he's written, you know, you can't deny the things that he says because he knows as an expert on almost all of the things and or relying on an actual expert and not just like, you know, a rando tour guide that he found on the street. I think that, you know, you can't say like, oh, you know what? I don't really trust that guy.
And when he doesn't know, he's the first to admit it. And
exactly.
That's what made his travel writing so engaging as well, because mm-hmm. it wasn't him coming in as trying to be an authority in somewhere in Southeast Asia. It was him learning. And I think one of the kind of through lines you can see from Kitchen Confidential into A Cook's Tour and the shows beyond was his, not just like willingness, but like his absolute determination to like give a voice to the kind of disenfranchised, to the mm-hmm. ones who didn't have a voice prior. So like Kitchen Confidential was all about what was going on with the Central and South American line cooks and dishwashers and everything else. And that's when you really got into what really happens behind these these doors of even like the fanciest restaurants. And in the same way, I think, especially in his later years on television, when he got into Parts Unknown and stuff, it was about, you know, showing the daily life, humanity of Palestinians, or, you know, like going into places that other people might only consider based on news headlines and statistics, and like showing the humanity there. And I think like that's kind of a through line there, where you could almost say he was kind of always behind the underdogs in a way. You
know? Yeah, he's one of these people, we talk about this a lot in art and with artists, and that is a category into which I would definitely put him. Mm-hmm. He was a writer first and foremost. You have to remember that Kitchen Confidential actually wasn't his first book. He had written fiction. He was a cook, and then he was a writer. And I think it's important to remember that. But I do feel like he's somebody who's got a through line of evolution, which is something we talk about with artists a lot, but often it doesn't pan out. But for me, starting with Kitchen Confidential and who he was in the position that he was in at the time, and taking that core value system that you just talked about, which is, who are the people behind this? Mm-hmm. What do they do? What is their daily life like? He wasn't just about the salacious sort of don't eat fish on Mondays. He was about, here's what's going on behind this door. And yes, there was salacious stuff about that, but it was also about who those people were and really going deep on what their daily life was like. And that he brought them to life in a way that made them accessible to us in a way that people, I think, had not been able to get in touch with before.
And he was also one that was like you said about evolution, that you could chart that evolution over the course of his career. I mean, if you read Kitchen Confidential now, I've read it twice, and I read it most recently, maybe like last year. Mm. I mean, he says some shit in that book that's like borderline misogynistic,
yep,
or borderline homophobic. You know, like he was a young kind of maverick, whatever, cook, and he was trying to definitely put that face forward in that book. But the thing is, he'd be the first to admit, or he would have been the first to admit now, and he has admitted that he made some missteps.
He did, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. That, like, he said some things, and then, you know, he, in his final days, he was one of the most vocal male proponents of the Me Too movement. So it can really show, I think, first and foremost, just shows the willingness he had to change his mind, to learn, to the openness he had to the rest of the world. And I think that's one of like the biggest takeaways I took from it.
You can definitely especially see that in the West Virginia episode, which kicked off season 11. He went there as someone who...
Of which show?
Of Parts Unknown.
Okay.
His final season.
Yes, the final season, which just finished this past week. I mean, Bourdain was super liberal, like did not like guns, and he went to this town and he really showed that hallmark of just sitting down and listening to people and eating dinner with them and going down into the coal mines without any judgment. He was just there to learn and to really like see what life was like there. And he came out saying that it was such an amazing place and he felt so welcomed, even though it so often gets stereotyped as a really conservative, harsh place. And I mean, it was great. It was one of my favorite episodes that I've watched as I've been doing these recaps.
And that's kind of a nice bookend. Mm-hmm. They bookended so nicely a lot of this stuff, because the other thing I wanted to mention at some point is you wrote about this on Monday, Bridge, which is the final episode of Parts Unknown.
Right.
Not to be super programmatic about this, but I honestly do see a through line between Kitchen Confidential to Cook's Tour to No Reservations to Parts Unknown. Each of those things are all of a piece. They're like movements of a symphony, or they really are like stages of a career.
Totally.
You know, the same idea motivates all of them, but you can see that idea evolving, changing, deepening, and getting more complicated and interesting as he moves through those. So I don't think that's overstating the case. Mm-hmm. Anyway, going back to this stage, so Kitchen Confidential comes out, the time in which, and again, this is maybe more accessible to me in memory than to you guys, because I think you came of age in a world in which this already happened. Mm. But it was an era where there were budding celebrity chefs. The Food Network had started to really pick up steam. Batali, Wolfgang Puck, Bobby Flay, Emeril Lagasse, with whom he had like these terrible feuds. Or hilarious feuds, really.
Guy Fieri.
That was a little bit later, but like this. So this is kind of like a golden age, or the sort of cresting of the celebrity chef. And Bourdain enters with Kitchen Confidential. He's a chef. He's got this best-selling book. And then they go and make a show. And what was interesting to me at the time is that instead of making a cooking show, and instead of even making like a restaurant show where you go to, he's doing Les Halles, which is what he had written about, and the métier of a restaurant and the bustling kitchen and the characters that are there, which would have made for great television, they do a travel show. And again, like, to me, there's a chicken and egg in terms of the book versus the show. I think the show came first. I think that the story there is like people came to him and sort of said like, hey, we have this idea. But it felt like such a natural progression. And I'm wondering, what do you think about, what do you guys think about, it is about him that lends him particularly to travel. Like, why did that make sense for somebody like him where it didn't make sense for Wolfgang Puck?
I mean, I think the proof is in what he produced. It's hard to tell until you do it, and then you're like, wow, this guy's perfect for this role. And then he might not have known really why he wanted to do it in the first place. But, like, you see, there could have been, and there have been since, shows around traveling and food that kind of turn into basically, like, Fear Factor, where it's like, I'm going to try this crazy shit, and you're going to watch me and
that
squirm in your seat.
That is the premise of an actual show.
Right, exactly. And
Are you talking about Zimmern's show?
Yeah.
Like,
I just want to say, Zimmern is way more than that, right? Like, I know that that's the premise of the show.
Yeah.
But Zimmern and Bourdain ultimately are of a piece, I think. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
He does try some, you know, very unfamiliar stuff. But the approach he has, even from the beginning, when I think he was, if you watch like an episode of A Cook's Tour now, like it's a pretty different Bourdain. It's like oversized linen, chain smoking, you know, a little more kind of even more like uncouth, I guess I'd say, than he was towards the end of his life. And also says some stuff where you're like, huh, wait a second, this is clearly from the early 2000s. but even then, his approach to like trying something new, trying something unfamiliar, trying like, you know, partially fertilized egg in the Philippines or something, which a lot of people would just do for the gross out factor. There's like a genuine curiosity that's driving that. And there's a genuine like, who the hell am I to say whether this is good or not or gross or not? And yeah. I'm going to try it because that's my entry point into this culture. That's my entry point into the conversation with the person who's sitting across from me. And I think you see that right away. And I think it comes from, you know, maybe parts of his past in the restaurant business as a little bit hedonistic, a little bit rambunctious, whatever. And I think that carried over, but it carried over in the sense that it just fueled his curiosity versus him being like a showman, so to speak.
But I think the thing that made it so interesting was even with his restaurant background, when he would go travel to all these places, especially with what I saw on Parts Unknown, like the food that he was almost happiest to eat a lot of the time was just like casual street food. Like he was just as happy getting noodles in Vietnam as he was eating like 5-star chanterelle ice cream in Newfoundland. So like he ate everything really, like even shark fin in Iceland.
Yeah.
When I think some of my favorite episodes across all of his TV shows were the ones that had those like big parental warnings at the beginning where they were like, if you have children who are squeamish, like do not watch this show because we will butcher a like full goat on your TV screen. And for me, as a very picky eater growing up, it was kind of my first, like truly as someone who only ate mac and cheese and chicken fingers for probably an entire year of my life.
Relatable.
Like, no, I think it showed me like, okay, this guy's like taking this really seriously and it's not that like, oh my gosh, look at me eat this crazy thing. Yeah. It was like,
because then if that was the case, you'd still be grossed
been like,
out.
Oh, yeah. Look at that crazy thing. Yeah. No, I think that like he took everything seriously enough that I could too from my couch. He seems like a guy that would go out and try stuff, and I want to be a girl that goes out and tries stuff. And I think that those episodes, the ones with the parental guidance little screens at the beginning for any of his shows, were some of my favorite episodes because everything, even if it was graphic or odd or something that I would never have expected any person to eat, it showed me that it was super normal.
It was curiosity and not wide-eyed naivete either, you know? And I think you saw that because as the shows progressed from one to another, you know, like some of my favorite episodes are like when he goes to Vietnam, not for the first time on the show, but for like the fifth time, you know? And like suddenly he doesn't need the guide anymore. Suddenly he's the guide and he's like showing some other people around, or like when he goes to Sichuan province with Eric Ripert. I don't know if you saw that episode.
I haven't.
But
seen
it's incredible. And it's like, you know, he already knows where to go and he already knows the heat he's about to get literally from Sichuan food, the spice he's about to hit, but Eric Ripert has no idea. And he just like puts him through the paces and just like, of course, with CNN, with the Parts Unknown team, 0.0 Productions, I think is the name of the production company. They just do such a good job of like dramatizing it. Of course, it's like slow motion, Ripert just sweating and like about to pass out and dramatic music over it. But the point is, you know, not saying that he would turn himself into an authority, but he wasn't going to go into each episode like, ooh, what's the crazy shit I'm going to try today? And like, what's the big shock I'm going to have about this place? No, like, he knows Vietnam. You know, he's going to go back to Vietnam because he loves going to Vietnam. And he's going to say as much in the intro to the episode. And but, I think you follow along with him in that journey because of that.
I love those transitions as well. But I also love his use of the guides. Mm-hmm. And yeah, totally. I love that he, again, acting as a proxy for us as viewers and as spectators mm-hmm. on this, uses the guides. He turns himself over to those guides.
And like sometimes right? it's like just like a software developer who happens to just like know the food scene in that city so well.
Yeah.
You know, it's great. It's not just like the food tour operator.
Yeah. Yeah. Typically, it is not commercial. Yeah. Even when he's going with the owner of Les Halles and the two of them are traveling together, it is not a commercial thing, no. right? This is not about that relationship. It's not about the restaurant business. It's typically just about having fun in the place and eating really well. And that guy knows the stuff. But what I love about it is, as the sort of alpha figure in the series, he takes a beta moment and he backs off and he really turns himself over to this person. And as a proxy for us, I love the modeling behavior that goes into that, because again, it's a manifestation. It's literally a manifestation of him saying, I don't know what I'm doing here. And I need somebody to show me around and educate me about this culture, this place. And I think that's something that we talk a lot about travelers feeling anxiety about, right? Yeah. And I don't mean to bring this back in a programmatic kind of way, but I do think that there's something about that that is the appropriate posture for a traveler in a strange place to take, which is, I don't know what I'm getting into.
Humility.
Humility. Yeah. I'm Absolutely. Curious. I'm interested. I want to know, and I'm open. And I want to turn myself over to other people to guide me.
And I think there were so few shows, at least in my experience, watching channels like the Travel Channel mm-hmm. like my whole life, that had so many different people come on as guests and co-hosts, because I think for so much of the content that is still out there, it's like a white American person goes to another place and tells you, the watcher, viewer, what to do, where to stay.
Yeah.
And I think for him to say, okay, cool, you are going to play a very important role in this episode, and I need you to show me and all of these people around mm-hmm. this place that you know so well, I think that that makes it automatically feel like you can trust him more, because he does the thing that we all want to do when we travel, right. which is just give ourselves over to this experience.
This like 7-minute scene is literally just going to be me and you eating noodles and me asking you question after question after question.
About noodles.
Or about the place.
Right.
Or about the politics of the place or the culture or the religion or anything else that comes up when you're eating. You
Having
know?
A totally normal conversation like you would anywhere.
Food is the entry point. Yeah. You know, it's not necessarily like, what's in this dish? No. It's like, what do you do about censorship in Myanmar? Anyway, this is delicious, you know?
A lot of them were journalists, I think, on the past couple of seasons. Like, he met with a journalist in Lagos.
Yeah.
Thank you. Or, like, chefs in Uruguay. But it's really that principle, because we've talked about this before, about, like, when you go somewhere new, the best thing that you can do is to just immerse yourself and just, like, sit down in a cafe or a bar and just talk to people. And, like, that's the best way that you're going to get all of the recommendations for, like, how you should spend your days and fill your itineraries, what museums you have to check out, where you should get this drink, where you should stay. Like, that's the absolute best thing you can do. And he made it seem so easy and accessible because it was such a natural conversation, just like talking to a friend over a beer.
100% my solo travel, eat at a bar and make friends mindset is like, embrace your inner Bourdain, embrace your inner Bourdain, like be outgoing, like be cool, Meredith.
Be curious.
Yeah, like just talk to people, you know, and ask them questions about themselves, because they're likely going to open up to you, curious, interested person.
But I think, again, I want to come back, like, I'm sorry to keep insisting on this, but I want to come back to him as an artist and as a writer. Because what I find so remarkable about that, about what you're talking about, is that he did give a sense that he loved people mm-hmm. and that whenever he would go somewhere, he genuinely wanted to connect and he had that openness. That's rare for an artist and a writer.
And I feel like that earnestness almost always paid off. And in the few times that it didn't, including in my all-time favorite episode of No Reservations, he totally owned up to it. And in 2011, they aired an episode visiting Haiti. And mm-hmm. there's a scene in the episode where he and his crew are surrounded by all of these kids who are clearly so hungry, and they try to do the right thing, which is all of the food that they are shooting and filming at this woman's stand, they decide to buy it all and just feed everyone who's around them, which naturally backfires because you can't just buy up a person's food and just drop it in a place and think that anywhere around the world, like, it's going to be an orderly, well-processed, enjoyable experience for anyone, you or the children or grown adults who are coming to get the food. And I think that being able to show, like, I tried to do this thing that I thought was going to be a good idea because I care and because I want these people to have this food that I am just standing here filming and not eating or eating a single plate of, and then moving on, I think that moment kind of showed how open and earnest and concerned and interested and loving he was for the people that made it into the show.
In this case, especially, and this is, you know, age-old argument, but I don't think you can, like, separate the person and the art, right? Especially for him, I feel like he had a lot of control over how these shows were produced and how they were filmed and how he was portrayed, and I think it was very honest to the person he is. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't think it was like an altruistic view of humanity necessarily. I think it was more driven by curiosity and about genuine curiosity and about the genuine desire to connect with people from and learn from the world around him. After a Parts Unknown episode in 2013, where he went to the West Bank, Gaza, and Israel, he won an award after that from a kind of Muslim advocacy group, American Muslim advocacy group, for the portrayal of Muslims that he put forward. Mm-hmm. And in his acceptance speech, he said, just, quote, people are not statistics. That's all we attempted to show. And I think that's some humility on his part, I'm sure. But I think it's also, it was something he tried to show. And he wasn't afraid to take these stands that might, like, blow up Twitter for a second or, you know, piss off a few people in power. Like, there's a famous quote, his quote on Henry Kissinger, which is just incredible.
Oh, we this is so amazing, his words about Henry Kissinger.
I don't know if we want to read it all, but it was something that I think, like, a lot of people, probably a lot of Cambodians, a lot of Cambodian Americans, a lot of people who, like, experience that firsthand will see, will read and be like, holy shit, like, the mainstream media actually does have our back. And that's another thing, was that he was using this giant platform that's not very well known. You know, we're talking CNN, we're talking the Travel Channel, we're talking places that aren't necessarily well known for taking these stands or giving these voices to people. And he was just like, fuck that, I'm doing it. And I think, and the fact that it resonated with people just showed that there was a working formula in a way.
So let me, again, back up to his evolution in all of this in the show, to show evolution. Mm-hmm. I watched last night, you know, thinking about this discussion we were going to have today, I went back to No Reservations season 2, the Lebanon episode, Beirut episode. Mm-hmm. So I watched that again, and for me, this marks a transformative moment for him. And I don't know if you guys have watched this or if you've watched it recently enough for it to be fresh in your minds, but you can see this as a watermark during not just that show, but his career kind of generally. And it's where he kind of goes from being the person who drops into the place, doing the thing that they do. And this literally takes place over the course of that show, and he kind of creates this narration around it, you know? One thing people should know, if you don't already, you probably do, he was a writer for his show, and he wrote a lot of those narrations that go in between. Mm-hmm. He was very insistent upon that. Again, back to what I keep saying, this guy was a writer at the end of the day, among other things, of course. And during that show, you see this transition from him dropping into Beirut and doing the thing that they had done on that show and to some extent on Cook's tour, which is, let me connect with a local. In this case, friend of the brand, it's Ramsey Short, who works on our London guide, who was at the time the newly appointed editor-in-chief of Time Out Beirut, which was kind of a remarkable thing. There were only 11 cities at the time that had a timeout, and Beirut getting one was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And then Bourdain and No Reservations showing up there was a big deal, and everybody was excited. And so he had another guide other than Ramsey during the show, Ramsey, who he hooked up with halfway through the show. And you know, suddenly the Hezbollah goes and kidnaps a couple of Israeli soldiers and killed a couple of others, and Israel starts bombing Lebanon. And the rest of the episode, for those of you who haven't seen it, is Bourdain kind of narrating their attempts to deal with this situation as a television production crew who has basically come to do a Good Time Charlie show in Beirut, and they can't do that anymore. The whole plan has been completely scrapped. Beirut is on lockdown. They end up on lockdown. And this is where this burgeoning of a dual consciousness that he's always had, but it starts to reach meta level for me at that moment, because there's a whole segment where after they get moved, and there are all these parallels to Vietnam, right, that are happening there. They're parallels to the, maybe it's just because I'm reading the Quiet American at the same time, but there's all these parallels to the American presence in Vietnam that I know is always top of mind for him, which is they get moved to this very sort of swanky hotel, and they spend a lot of time hanging out with people in the hotel, trying to get out of Beirut, trying to get basically get rescued by the Marines. And there are a couple of things that are super remarkable. For if you, any of you guys remember this episode, shut me up and say.
I remember seeing it, but not well enough that I saw it last night to be able to say, like, these things happened in this order. So
and our listeners
continue.
Might not. So.
It's really remarkable in terms of his transition, because you see him becoming a thing while he's doing this and then realizing that this is a moment. They get moved to this hotel. They have this guy that he calls Mr. Wolf, after the Tarantino character, who is their fixer. And it's unclear whether this guy is actually working for the government. It's some sort of shady thing. But he's basically giving them a privileged position to navigate this extremely dangerous situation that a lot of other people don't have. And Bourdain has consciousness of that, and he talks about that, right? And then they get ensconced in this fairly luxury hotel in a position that is excised from the actual danger, and they spend the rest of the conflict waiting to figure out how they're going to get out and get rescued by the Marines. And to be fair, lots of other people are doing the same thing. The French are doing the same thing. Other internationals are doing the same thing. So it's not like they were the only ones. But meanwhile, you know, he has this dual level of consciousness about what the show is and how they kind of came to this, and the fact that that has all been completely changed and his mindset has been completely changed, and it will not be the same after this. They can't do the show the same way. What was remarkable to me, a couple of things, again, in keeping with this character, but transformative in the way that he approaches them during the show. One is his cast and crew. Again, this is a guy who comes up through the restaurant business. He's used to working with a close-knit group of people, and I feel like every cast that he worked with on every show that he was on, that same dynamic evolved. They were always small. It was always like 3, 4, 5 people that they were going to these places, not giant production, you know, crews that were going in and cleaning everything up. So very guerrilla. And they all get ensconced together, and it is very much like people in a war zone, right? Mm-hmm. Which it was, but not kind of in the way that they had. Number two, there's this point at which he goes down, like the stress is bugging everybody out, and he goes down to the kitchen in the hotel, and everybody knows who he is, and they know why he's there, and he goes and he cooks for everybody because it's his way of dealing with stress. And I loved his humility at that moment, but also his leveraging to do something nice for people, leveraging his clout to do something that was just a general break from the routine and was nice for everybody, including him. And he owns that completely. Like, I needed to do this. I had to get back to a thing that was going to make me feel okay. And then the third thing that happens in that episode that I think is revelatory of his character is when they finally do get out and they end up getting on a boat with the Marines to get out of Beirut, he is incredibly conscious of the Marines themselves, makes an effort to talk to them, makes an effort to get to know individuals of there, and makes an effort in his narration to really call out those soldiers and what they did for these people and how they were human and individualized, and to try to not let them be this kind of like faceless military voice, but actual humans who connected with the people that they were helping out. And that generosity of spirit, it was remarkable to me that it starts at the beginning of the episode with Beirut itself and with the population of Beirut and the people that he was encountering, the restaurant that he goes to before all this breaks out, mm-hmm. all the way to the Marines at the end of the thing. And it's just like, there's something innate about it to him.
And I think that's what I was trying to get at, like what extends to, this is a hard thought to wrap my head around, but it's like almost what you're saying about how he treated the Marines and everything else, how he treated people in West Virginia, I think it just goes towards how he treated people in general, from no matter where they came from. It was just like a humanizing force in a world of media that wasn't necessarily always very humanizing, that often did the opposite. That was, you know, in their treatment of the East was full-on Orientalism, you know, on the treatment of Africa was full-on dark continent bullshit, you know? And, like, I think that was just something that, like, you could see throughout his life, from when he was talking about the Ecuadorian dishwasher to when he was talking about the Marine in Beirut to when he was talking about the cook in Bali. And I think that's what really got me excited about what, and I think what really changed the world, I think, changed the way people talk about the world was that, and it seems so simple and it seems like something everybody should be doing, but that's not always the case in terms of mass media. And I think he brought that to a platform, and I think that's why so many people from all over the world came out in mourning of his death, because it resonated with so many people, whether it's a Palestinian in the Gaza Strip or a Marine or, you know, a travel writer. And I think that's what did it. And it was like almost like it gave people back their sense of like ownership and pride of a place, even when he was your guide to that place. And I think about, I'm not Indonesian, but, you know, people who have listened to this podcast before know that I spent some formative years there, and it has a very special place in my heart. And I think about like an early episode he did for No Reservations, where he was in Bali and he goes to, you know, Ibu Oka's Babi Guling, which is a slow roasted pig, which like I knew about, and I was very happy to see him there. And, you know, I was stoked to felt proud there. And then he, of course, does this. He has this whole monologue at the end where he talks about how he could see himself just dropping the show and settling down there forever.
He said that about Vietnam, too.
I know. Like, he says that about a few places.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just like it felt good to hear. So, you know, it's because it's such a rare portrayal of a place. And I can't imagine what that's like in a place that is even more in upheaval or turmoil, for somebody from that place to see that and be like, yes, like this is what I've been trying to tell people, that you can sit down, you can have an incredible meal, you can make incredible connections with people, and the shit you're seeing in the news isn't the full story.
Yeah, but it's unfiltered. Oh, sorry.
And no, he'd always deny he's a journalist, but that was like some of the most valuable journalism I saw and read. Yeah.
And I'll say that he did that for places that, you know, travelers are traveling to, like Bali, but he also did that for places like Houston, which I re-fell in love with after having gone there every Christmas for my entire life when he did his Houston episode and showed all of the different sides of Houston that aren't just like rodeo, concrete jungle, world's largest highway.
Most diverse city in the U.S., right?
Exactly. And I think like there are so few, but that's the thing, like, you know, being from Texas, that definitely doesn't get shown,
right?
Especially about a place like Houston that has, you know, its own struggles with just weather, honestly. Yeah. And I think that it made me see those far off places in a totally different light. But it also made me see like Virginia and Houston, like places closer to home that I never would have been like, oh, you know what? I want to travel there and see this because now I've seen it through his eyes.
Yeah, I saw the Seattle episode of Parts Unknown before going to Seattle. There's a New Jersey episode. Bourdain was from New Jersey. I haven't watched it yet. I'm saving it. But like, as someone you guys all know who's very passionate about New Jersey, it's great to know that someone went there without any biases and just showed it for what it is. Like he did with any destination anywhere in the world. Just like, here's what's going on. There's no filter. There's no lens or prejudices. It's just, here's what's going on. Here's how people live. And here's what you should eat while you're there, if you have time.
Can you guys talk about the transition to Parts Unknown from No Reservations? I feel like that show, number one, it was a big step up. And for anyone who hasn't read Patrick Radenkeef's portrait of Bourdain in The New Yorker, shout out to fellow Connie Brand, but it's an absolutely amazing piece. And he gets at some of these sort of transitions as well and some of these shifts. But for me, I have not seen Parts Unknown. I watched No Reservation, like a bunch of No Reservations. I watched Cook's Tour. I'm sort of old school. I got the OG part of this. But I watched recently the first episode of Parts Unknown, which is now available in its entirety on Netflix, I believe.
So the first
first eight seasons
of 11 are all on Netflix. And I know there were a lot of rumors that it was going to get pulled off because the contract had expired and Netflix has re-signed the licensing contract. So it will be, for the foreseeable future, available for you to watch.
And this is really great if you have a Netflix subscription, because No Reservations is actually not available on any of the subscription streaming services. You have to actually buy the seasons, which is well worth it. But it's nice that you can see all of Parts Unknown. But watching the beginning of that, I do feel like that show makes a bunch of statements right out of the gate. Episode one, which is Myanmar, which I felt like the decision to go to Myanmar at that point in time, which was, I believe, 2012. You know, talking about Myanmar now is not the same as talking about Myanmar in 2012. And, you know, it's hard for us to go back 6 years in time and recapture the mentality. But not only that, but the production values clearly kick up. You know, now we're at CNN. Now we've got some more budget to play with. They used it extremely well. Like, the photography just becomes gorgeous. And also, that first episode in Myanmar ends on, do you guys remember how it ends? It ends on a note that would be familiar to us, in the sense that they go out to a sort of zone where there's all these temples that have been built. Many, 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 many temples.
Bagan.
Okay. Thank you. And they look at the temple. They talk about how they were constructed. They talk about the history of these things. And then he has this moment where he realizes that not only is increasing tourism going to threaten the very things that he's talking about, but he himself and his show presents this moral quandary about... Sorry, go ahead.
So you mentioned the Patrick Redden-Keefe article, the long profile that came out.
Yes.
Before he died, right?
It came out before he died.
Few months.
Yeah.
And then he wrote like a follow-up.
But it was like 2 years in the reporting. Yeah. Like, it's extensive.
So
it's
really... I actually wrote about that article for CN Traveler when it came out, because it was, like you said, so fucking good. But one of the things, I mean, the main focus of what I was focusing on there was that Anthony Bourdain didn't shy away from the fact that food, and global food in particular, is political. And I think that's the shift that happened with Parts Unknown, was like a full embracing of that. Was that like, listen, this isn't just going to be me talking about how awesome this place is and how amazing the food is and taking you around with a little bit of introduction to the culture and the politics of the place. I'm going to face this stuff head on. And maybe it was something like, you know, maybe it was that Beirut episode that changed his framework there. But I think with Parts Unknown was when he really stopped shying away from that and fully embraced it. And like, that is the crux of the Myanmar episode, right? It's about talking about the change from a militaristic dictatorship to a, you know, supposed democracy. Things are looking a little bleaker
shaky
now.
Yeah.
You know,
but he gets at that. He says, like, nobody really knows how this is going to work out.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing, you know, in, as far into the newer season with West Virginia, he's very clear about his approach. He's like, I'm entering Trump country, right? Like, it's like very clear that that's what he's there to confront. You know, and there was like another one about New England, like Massachusetts, which I think was a Parts Unknown episode, like Greenfield and all those places, where he was like, this episode's about the opiate epidemic, you know? So I think it was like a full, he's like, I've traveled the world now for however many years, and I've kind of skirted around these issues here and there, even though they're important to me and that they're hugely
they
important to the people
in,
I'm talking
yeah.
to, and they should be important to the world at large. Well, now I'm going to run straight into this traffic jam, basically.
Yeah. Well, food was like the conduit to get people to talk about what was going on. It wasn't the focus of the episode at all. It was more so just like, let's talk about this deep issue while we crack open a beer.
And I think it was like a recognition of like, yeah, of course food is political. It's like the one thing that's on every table, you know, it's on the table at dinner every night, and that's what's talked about, and that's what... If you go into the history of the food, it's hugely political about the ingredients used and how the ingredients got there and, you know, everything else. So I think it was like, this is partially what this show is going to be about, because you can't shy away from it.
Yeah. And he often, like in the recent seasons, he would like have an afterword or a forward voiceover. Like, for example, with the West Virginia episode, he went to a shooting range and then had a voiceover because the Parkland shooting happened a couple weeks after the episode was filmed. And then he went to that disputed territory in Azerbaijan and then was like, oh, yeah, I went there. And then a couple days later, I read in the newspaper that I'm not welcome there anymore, and addressed that as well. Like, it was, he really got into politics, especially in the last few episodes.
Do you guys consider him a journalist? What type of...
Yeah, 100%.
He didn't want to be considered a journalist, I think I read him
saying
that.
Yeah, I don't think he didn't call himself a journalist, and he was very clear about, like, saying, I'm not a journalist.
But in that tribute from his CNN coworkers, they said that he was probably the best journalist that they've ever seen, and had more curiosity and ability to really find a true story than anyone.
But I think part of the reason he would say that he wasn't a journalist, you know, and what I had read before, was because he'd be like, I have a clear bias and a clear perspective, and I'm going to put that forward.
But is that, you know, and again, this is super controversial, and I'm curious too, Mayor, what you think, because I think of you as a, like, very reportorial type person.
Thank you.
But
I feel
like is
I
that
need to sit up really straight.
Not that the rest of you are not, clearly. I am not. I will totally cop to that. I am a writer, not a journalist. You know, what is it that gives anybody who has talked about this in the last 3 weeks hesitancy to call him a journalist? What are the things that seem incompatible with that?
I mean, I think that in 2018, I think that there are fewer public journalists that walk that fine line, right, between putting their personal opinions out there and being 100% unbiased in their reporting. I think that especially in the political space right now, there are a lot of people that are being very vocal as journalists about their own opinions, and it's influencing how they write. And I think that in those terms, if those people are going to work as journalists, which I think they can and should, he would fit into that description, right? Because he told stories, found stories, shared people's lives in a visual and written way. But part of me, like, agrees with him that, like, I think he's so much more than that.
But at the same time, if you're talking about travel journalism, and if you're talking about travel journalism when, and not including just the reporting of travel news, if travel journalism was journalism as we're defining it here, you know, you'd be like, Dubai is hot, sandy and tall. The end.
Dubai is, like, tall. No, I
but,
think,
you know, but, he was like, that perspective is going to come in when you're talking about a place, because that's your recommendation giving, right?
I think there are people, like, a lot of people in our office we would consider travel journalists rather than travel writers.
Mm-hmm. What is the difference? Can you tell me? Can you articulate? You're like, I gotta go to dinner.
No. I think it's really hard to, I think it's like a Venn diagram, and figuring out what part overlaps is what is really
let me ask this.
For me, because, like, to me, a travel writer is on the road always, and a travel journalist is not always on the road.
Okay, but let me ask this. Do you question his commitment to truth and facts and, like, evidence?
No.
This is my opinion. I would totally trust him that if he made a mistake, if he got something wrong, mm-hmm. he would 100% come back and correct it.
100%. You know? Well, I think, in my opinion, the reason this is such a hard question to answer and to drill down in, and why there's so many kind of different opinions on where he lies in this Venn diagram, mm-hmm. is because he redefined travel journalism.
Yeah.
Is because he completely reconfigured what that means and what it means to report on a place and what it means to tell a story from a place. And I think he was just, you know, just as devoted to the facts of a place. And that's why he was so curious and so interested in getting into those facts and the history and the, you know, political situation, the transformation going on in Myanmar, or the reality of coal miners in mm-hmm. West Virginia, as he was telling you that, like, this meal is fucking delicious, you know? Yeah. So I think it's like, he's like this new
he's the
thing.
Whole Venn diagram.
Yeah. He's the whole Venn diagram.
That's the answer.
And we are just trying to hang on to one little section of it. Yeah.
Okay, let me sort of again beg this question to some extent, right? Like, this is an age-old question with journalism, right? And not to keep it in Southeast Asia, but there's this famous photograph known as the Napalm Girl photograph, right? You guys familiar with this?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is a photograph that was taken by an AP photographer named Nick Ut of a Vietnamese girl who was running down the street away from, you know, a battle. You know, she was clearly in distress. What is your responsibility as a journalist? And this is a constant debate. Don't mean to single out Nick Ut or this photograph, but when you have that occasion, when that is happening and you are reporting that, where does your obligation end? What is your obligation? Number one, you're there to report, you're there to document and bring back, and that's clear. But do you actually get involved? And I think Bourdain's answer to that, though he did not think of himself as a journalist, was number one, you document and you go in with open eyes and you go in without prejudice as much as you can, and you absorb and you learn. That to me feels very journalistic. His approach to West Virginia that you keep talking about, Bridget, is basically like, I may have preconceived notions, but when I walk into this, I'm going to check those and I'm going to open myself to observation. I'm going to open myself to experience. I'm going to open myself to what happens here.
Well, one of the things that he did with Parts Unknown was after he would film an episode, he would have a post-production note, like field notes, which you can find on explorerpartsunknown.com. And it was just like several paragraphs of reflection about what happened when he was there and what he experienced and kind of just like his closing thoughts. And a lot of the times he would talk about how his opinions were turned on their head, or he had come to find something different than what he had expected, particularly with that West Virginia episode, and I'm sure with many others.
Well, I think
you're talking about, you go back to the example Meredith cited where he buys out the full, you know, and tries to feed people. I think his answer is grab a fucking coat, put the camera down, grab a coat, put it around the girl.
But again, you're talking about like, it's almost like it's a question that exists across disciplines, right? Like anthropology too.
Yes.
It's like the observational versus participatory anthropology, all that stuff. And I think it's like where, again, in my opinion, it's where travel journalism, unless we're talking travel news reporting, travel journalism, as at least the way that I see it, sets itself apart. And that, like, you can't report on a place unless you've interacted with the place and its people. Or otherwise, you are going to come home with an article that says Dubai is hot, tall, and dusty.
Yeah.
So, like, I think, again, that's where I feel like Bourdain took that conversation, took that debate. And while he might have said publicly that I don't think I'm a journalist, I think, like, damn right you were a travel journalist, because you defined the way that so many of us, at least me, who I still consider myself a travel journalist and a travel writer, but I think I am, you know, influenced so much by what he did to the point where, like, he paved the way for that. And I think it's maybe the reason it's such a contentious question is because it's so new, and it's because he was the one who turned it on his head when before that it was like travel writing was Richard Francis Burton in the 19th century writing this like orientalist bullshit about the East, and you know,
Bruce Chatwin and Pico Ayer.
Right, okay.
It's more complicated than that.
No, obviously, but I'm saying, like, in terms of like a drastic change, I feel like he was the one to do it on a mass media scale, at least on
for
a
sure.
scale that was on, you know, CNN and cable television, basically on that scale.
So let me ask you guys another sort of final question about this relative to our business and travel. And again, you may have a different perspective on this than I do, given when you came of age. But we talk a lot about immersive travel. We talk a lot about experience being the new luxury or the new definition for what travel is motivated by. How can we measure? What do you guys think is his role in popularizing that version of travel? Because whether you know it or not, again, I don't know where you guys are coming from, that is not always been definitive of the discourse, but it is in our era.
I think it's been interesting to see the commodification of experience, and I'm literally using air quotes. There are so many.
It's charming.
But I think, you know, with Airbnb experiences, connecting you with a local so that you could get a tour of the Bronx, or you could go eat in someone's house, or you could go to a concert. You know, you have that experience that you book with locals through Airbnb. I think it, in part, gives you access to all of those things that he wanted us to see and all of those people that he would have wanted us to get connected with. But I think it takes away so much of like that spontaneity and like joy of discovery that comes with like not booking time every hour of your day to like meet locals.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's real. I think like I would take issue with the concept of like immersive travel as the new luxury, because that makes me think of like, you know, basically slumming it.
Yeah.
And that whole concept of like, I'm going to go and like see what the real, but I have issue with that word too.
Yeah.
So like, you know, I think what he did was basically just say through his writing, through his television. You don't need to be as scared as you think you need to be about the rest of the world.
Yeah.
You don't need to be as scared as you think you need to be about like leaving your hotel and just going for a walk in Hanoi and seeing what happens.
Right. And I think like, the difference between like the travel industry that stands, that part of the travel industry that stands now and like where his path was taking all of us was, you know, now it's really easy to say, okay, cool, tour guide, like pick me up and walk me through the streets of Hanoi.
Right. He was the proponent for, like you said, spontaneity, for exploring parts unknown, you know, and I think it was like a demystifying of a lot of places. And I think that's like a lot of the value he brings that a lot of people who would be, and maybe, you know, rightfully so based on the media portrayals of these places before he came along, right? Maybe rightfully so scared of going out and like really just like putting yourself out there and meeting new people and letting that be your entry into new culture. He was proof of how possible it is, but also how like fun it could be.
Yeah.
And how eye-opening it could be and how informative and how educational it could be.
Everything seemed accessible when you watched the world through his eyes. Like no place was too far away, too big, too scary to go to. I mean, like just from my own personal experience, like I know we hate this word, but my bucket list has like infinitely expanded since watching his shows.
Right.
Like I want to go everywhere. And I think in the end, that's ultimately what he wanted to convey. Just like go out there and go see everything.
But I think the way that he did that was very different from the colonial version of that.
Right. Oh, definitely.
Which is that, right, like, and this is what I think is the transition in mentality, is that the previous version of that is that the world is safe because we've made it safe and because we're going to pave the way for you.
Mm-hmm.
His version of that is, open yourself up, submit yourself to the local version of reality, whatever that is, and that is your way forward. And you're setting aside fear in a different kind of way, and the security that you feel is a different kind of security, much more receptive and open and humble. Yeah.
And in fact, throughout all of that, the whole way through, he's also calling out the colonial way of thinking and making you reconsider things that the way you've approached travel in the past, or maybe things you've done in the past. And that's really, I think, the effect he had, is changing all of us as travelers too.
So I'm going to leave you with one thing that I think I know the answer to, but was he a one of a kind? Is there another person that is a standard bearer for what he stood for on the horizon?
Nope. No, not right now.
That was it, as far as I'm concerned, yeah.
Okay, that was clear and definitive.
Yep.
I
okay.
mean, if someone else comes up that has that kind of influence and that kind of capacity to change the world, the way we think about travel in the world, it's going to be in a completely different way, right? So I think he was of a time and place, and he was of a personality that is just so singular.
Okay. Nailed it.
There we go.
So I hope we have paid tribute, at least in some fashion, to Bourdain and his influence on the travel world. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Now we're on to the basic, boring, stupid stuff that it feels very small to talk about, but this is how we do in the world. You got to roll credits. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. We are on iTunes. We are on SoundCloud. Visit us at cntraveler.com. And we are also on Facebook at Condé Nast Traveler. We're on YouTube at Condé Nast Traveler. And we're at cntraveler on Instagram and Twitter. And please do tweet at us. We would love to hear from you. We love the reviews. I don't know if you guys heard last week's episode that Mark guest hosted, but it was really terrific. So you should subscribe and make sure that you get the back catalog. Review us on iTunes, all of those kinds of things. I want to just throw a note out. We haven't really talked about how Anthony died. If you are having thoughts of suicide, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. Which is T-A-L-K, if you're spelling that out, or go to speakingofsuicide.com/resources for a list of additional resources. Please don't wait if that is the case for you or for someone that you know. Again, that's not really our focus here, but if that applies to you or someone you know, please take action on it. Do not wait. Seb, how can people get in touch with you?
You can reach me at Seb Modak, and you can direct all complaints of swearing to me instead of our reviews, because I think I was solely responsible for that, but in the spirit of Bourdain, right?
Hey, yeah. You can find me on Instagram at brhallinan.
Mayor.
And I'm at Oh Hey There Mayor.
And I'm Ed Bradrick. Have a great weekend, everybody. Watch Parts Unknown on Netflix.